Well, so far we have studied the definition of verbal plenary inspiration. We went over the subject of a natural outworking of that, which is inerrancy. Then we looked at objections to inerrancy. Tonight we really get into the weeds. This is where we get into the theory and then into the practice. What do we do in the actual arena? How do you discern what you're reading as you're reading your commentaries or your Christian books, if something is breaking out from verbal plenary inspiration or inerrancy? Right around the 2010s, maybe 2010 itself, there was a book which was published by Dr. Mike Lacona. At the time, he was the head of the North American Missions Board with regard to teaching apologetics. And he wrote this huge, fabulous book, The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. Fabulous book. In the book, which was his dissertation for school, his PhD, he made a number of comments that alarmed a number of Christians in the scholarly world. Many of them surrounded this passage, which I'm about to read. Are you ready? Matthew 27, verse 51. This is after the death of Jesus, but before the resurrection of Jesus. We read this. Behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. Did you catch the part where it switched from the apocalyptic genre to the historical genre? Let me put that a different way. Did you catch the part in that section, that little pericope, where it switched from the metaphorical to the literal? No? Well, did you catch the part where it switched back from the factual or literal or however you want to put it to the apocalyptic genre and the factual genre to the non-literal, metaphorical, poetic, legend genre? No? I feel like I'm at a Baptist church. Can I get an amen? Amen. Did you catch it? No, we didn't catch it. All right. Mike Lycona caught it for us. This is what he said on page 34. He says this, there is somewhat of a consensus among contemporary scholars that the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, belong to the genre of Greco-Roman biography, or bios. He's right. There is a consensus that when we say, what are the Gospels? They aren't poetry, they aren't apocalyptic, they aren't epistolary, they're not letters, they're not... What are they? Are they a sui generis, a unique genre? No. Most scholars, he's arguing and asserting, say that the Gospels refer to or in the genre of Greco-Roman biography. Okay. Bioi, bios is singular, bioi plural. Biographies, bioi offered the ancient biography great flexibility for rearranging material and inventing speeches in order to communicate the teachings, philosophy, and political beliefs of the subject. And they often included legend. Ooh, wait a minute. Now, we move from Greco-Roman biography to inventing speeches within this genre and even including legend. You know what legend is? Falsehood. It never happened. He writes, because bios, or Greco-Roman biography, was a flexible genre, it's often difficult to determine where history ends and legend begins. It seems to me that an understanding of the language of Matthew 27, verses 52 to 53, as, quote, special effects with eschatological Jewish texts and thought in mind, is most plausible. That this is special effects. Now, we know what special effects are. It's basically making something look like it happened, but it never did. So the raising of the saints in Matthew 27, 52, and 53, this was an example of special effects. And a Jewish eschatological text, what's that referred to? Eschatology or eschaton refers to the last things. So when we look at Jewish literature about the end of human history, it really matches what we read in Matthew 27, 52 to 53. And this is in the apocalyptic genre. He writes on page 185, the data surrounding what happened to Jesus is fragmentary and could possibly be mixed with legend. We may also be reading poetic language or legend at certain points, such as Matthew's report of the raising of some dead saints at Jesus' death, Matthew 27, 51 to 54. Do you see why people were alarmed? This split the Bible-believing scholarly community. Some people said we stand with Lycona. Other people said we do not stand with Lycona. Some people said we don't agree with his interpretation of a legend genre, poetry, apocalyptic genre, but we don't think he's breaking from inerrancy. Other people said he is breaking from inerrancy because he's denying something that is portraying itself as factual, historical, literal, whatever you want to call it. Let's begin here. Let's begin at somewhere where we can land definitively. Is there a legend genre? No. No. 2 Peter 1:16. We did not follow cleverly devised tales. Mythos. This is the root word from which we get the term myth. There is no legend genre. This doesn't exist. Peter here is staking his claim of his apostleship and the veracity of what he's teaching on what he saw at the Transfiguration in Luke 9, Mark 9, Matthew 17, respectively. Here he's saying, we didn't follow legend. We didn't follow myth. We didn't follow mythos. Later, Lycona said, well, it wasn't poetry. It wasn't legend, but it was apocalyptic. It was in the apocalyptic genre. And even said that term special effects. I was writing to a popular audience, and I was trying to explain it in a way that they could grasp it. No, he wasn't. This is his PhD dissertation. This is written in an academic press. This book is 750 pages long, and I can't tell you how many footnotes are in this book. This is not a popular work trying to write to the average layperson. This is a book that you have to slog through, and he said special effects. But let's give him a fair shake here. Let's take his words at face value. Maybe he made a mistake. And he's saying now it's in the apocalyptic genre. Before we go further, how would you answer this passage? Is this passage unbelievable? That you would have Jesus' death, his resurrection, and then after, all of these tens, hundreds of thousands of dead Jewish saints rising from their graves and flooding the city of Jerusalem, and we don't have any historical report? Well, we got Matthew, and who else? Mark? No. Luke? No. John? No. Oh, I'm sure it's in Jewish sources. They would have written this down if there's tens of thousands of witnesses coming in to the city of Jerusalem raised from the dead. Do the Jews record this? No. Do the Romans record it? No. Does Josephus record it? No. Does Philo record it? No. No first century witnesses. No Jewish, Roman. Nobody records it except for right here. We've got one source. And we're to believe that this is true? First, if you're a believer in the New Testament and you're not believing this on a leap of faith or blind faith, you believe that there are resuscitations in the New Testament. How many? Many. We have the case of Lazarus in John 11, Jairus' daughter in Mark 5, the widow of Nain's son in Luke 7, Tabitha, Acts 11:36, that was by Peter, Eutychus, the little boy that maybe some of you can relate with him after my teaching that he, you know, Paul taught for so long that he fell out of the window and died. Paul brings him back to life. And Jesus says, tell him what you have heard, that the dead, plural, are raised. Plural dead were raised in Jesus' ministry. Well, no kidding. Lazarus, Jairus' daughter, widow of Nain's son, Tabitha later, Eutychus later, and plural dead people were raised. Now, you might say, well, that's ridiculous that God could raise people from the dead. I mean, don't we know scientifically that nobody naturally rises from the dead? Look, nobody is arguing that people naturally rise from the dead. You're right. Nobody naturally rises from the dead. We're arguing that you supernaturally rise from the dead. There is no biological law that helps people rise and resuscitate from the dead. But if you believe that there is an infinite personal God, and you believe that he created the entire universe, as one person has said, the hardest verse in the Bible to believe is the first verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If he created the entire system, is he not free to enter into that system? As Francis Schaeffer liked to put it, we don't believe in a closed system of cause and effect. We believe in an open system of cause and effect. So we believe in natural law, we believe in science, we believe in physical laws and so forth, but we believe that God is free to enter into that. Okay, we believe in the Bible, we believe that. But again, remember we talked about your priors in probability language. If your priors are very low that the dead people can rise from the dead, and there's no source that could raise people from the dead, you're going to think this is ridiculous. However, if God is in the equation, your priors are raised through the roof. What are the chances that I could beat Steph Curry in a game of one-on-one? My priors there are pretty low. I mean, pretty low. I know you all have faith in me, but they're pretty low, okay? But what if it was a game of two-on-one and LeBron James and I were playing Steph Curry? Oh, the probability would be pretty high, wouldn't it? Just in the same way that I can't bench press 1,000 pounds, but what if you brought in a muscle man and two muscle men on each side of the bar and they helped lift that bar with me? Well, then the probability goes through the roof. The same is true here. If you have God in the picture, how does Jesus put it in Matthew 19? All things are possible. We also have limited first century sources. Why wasn't this reported by the Jews? Got a question. How many Jewish sources do we have in the first century? Well, Josephus at the tail end of the first century, yeah. He doesn't mention it. True, true. Well, we have Philo in the first century. He doesn't mention it. True, true. Philo was in Egypt, Alexandria, Egypt. He's not going to mention it. You know who else Philo doesn't mention? Jesus. Are you going to say Jesus doesn't exist because Philo doesn't mention him? Philo doesn't mention Christians. And he's a first century author. Would Jewish authors have reason to record a mass resurrection of believers in the city of Jerusalem? That would be excellent press for the burgeoning Christian movement. Why would they record that? So we don't have authors that are there. We don't have sources. What about Roman, Greco-Roman sources? Did you know that in the Latin works, we go from Livy in AD 17 to Tacitus in AD 110 with a huge lacuna in between, a big gap of literature? The Greco-Roman literature is lost to the ash heap of history. So I love when people say, we should have more sources on this. We should have more sources on Jesus. If he really lived, and if he existed, we should have it in the Roman sources. I like to ask, which ones? Which Roman source? What do you mean? No, I mean, like, which source should it be in? Josephus. It's there. Book 18. Yeah. Tacitus. It's there. Yeah. Book 15. It's there. Well, maybe some of the other sources. There were no sources at the time. And Rome was concerned with Rome. That's why we get mentions of Christians and Christ in the second century, because this movement had spread all the way to Rome. So who would have recorded this? It isn't in the, we shouldn't expect it. That's my point. We shouldn't expect it to be in the Jewish sources, nor in the Greco-Roman sources. We find it in a Christian source. I purposely exaggerated. I said tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people rising from the dead and storming the city of Jerusalem. Where did I get that figure? My own imagination. It doesn't say that here. What's it say? Paulus in Greek, many. You say, well, many, that sounds like a lot. How many is many? If you saw a bunch of people coming into the city of Jerusalem, how many would there need to be for you to say, that's a lot of people risen from the dead? For me, I would say two. That would be many. I will say this. In context, that word, paulos, many, is used in Matthew 27, verse 55, two verses later, same word, to refer to the many women who were watching Jesus from afar. Now, how many women showed up at the tomb? There's dispute over this, but I can tell you this. You can count them on one hand. So the way that Matthew, our author, is using this word two verses later, he's referring to a half a dozen tops. We simply aren't told how many people are there. Furthermore, there is a motive and a motivation for a cover-up. Well, how do you know that? I know it for this reason. John chapter 12, verse 9, Lazarus is raised from the dead. He's resuscitated by Jesus. And it says that the Jewish authorities wanted to kill Lazarus. Why? Because this was good evidence that Jesus was who he claimed to be. If you can get rid of the resuscitated man, if that's the case, well, then we can get rid of the evidence. So, would they have recorded this? No. Were there people there to record it? No. Do we have sources that don't mention it? No. And why would anyone want to give free press to the early Christian movement? I believe that this is probable. I believe that it's probable, given the entire perspective of the New Testament documents. Like we said before, if you give the argument, 90% of college students drink beer. Joe's a college student. That's a really good inductive argument that Joe drinks beer. But if Joe goes to Bob Jones University, where 90% of the students don't drink beer, then it would actually work in reverse. So probability rests on your priors, your prior probabilities, prior information. Here, what we're seeing is that the New Testament documents are reliable. Now, can I back this up with multiple attestation? You know, Matthew and Luke both refer to it, and so do John, and maybe Paul refers to it in 1 Corinthians 15, referring to the first fruits. No, I can't back it up. It's not multiply attested. Does it pass the criterion of embarrassment? Not really. It's just a terse, succinct mention of people rising from the dead. But the criteria that we use for history shouldn't be used against a historical event. What I mean by that is this. Well, that's not an embarrassing event, therefore it never happened. You just got rid of 99.9% of history. Great job. Well, that wasn't multiply attested. We don't have multiple sources all referring to it. We have one attestation. How about Mount Vesuvius, AD 90, blowing away Pompeii? Do you know how many sources we have on that? One. Pliny. And the only reason Pliny mentions it is because his uncle was there. An earth-shaking event, a volcano blowing away a couple cities. And we got one source on this in his letters. If it hadn't been for Pliny, we wouldn't have that mentioned at all. I don't think we should be embarrassed with this passage whatsoever. All right. Is this in the apocalyptic genre? Lycona gives a number of reasons why. In the apocalyptic genre, he argues, this is accompanied with darkness. In verse 45, remember the sky went dark when Jesus was crucified. That's part and parcel with apocalyptic literature. There were earthquakes. We see that in Joel. We see that in Daniel. We see that in Isaiah, the mountain being ripped apart, ripped to shreds. The earth shook. Apocalyptic. There you go. There's the opening of the tombs. We see that in Daniel chapter 12, which is apocalyptic literature, or the book of Revelation, apocalyptic literature. We see the same thing with regard to the raising of dead bodies. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but we see that in apocalyptic literature. So, Lycona says, this meets four criteria for apocalyptic literature, therefore it's apocalyptic literature. Just these three verses. The difficulty with that, these four criteria are all signifiers for Jesus' death and resurrection. The darkness, I like how he pulled that one from verse 45. That's not from this passage. That's from the death of Jesus. Was the death of Jesus in the apocalyptic genre? Hardly. Earthquakes. Remember the quote, severe earthquake that shook the tomb in Matthew 28, verse 2? We're talking about a dozen verses later in the next chapter. Was that in the apocalyptic genre? The opening of the tombs. Jesus' tomb was opened in just a few verses. Matthew 27, verse 60, Matthew 28, verse 8. Resurrected bodies, Matthew 28, verse 7. The same criteria used for the raising of the dead saints could just as easily be used for the resurrection of Jesus himself. Let's look at this closely. Verse 51. The veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, this is in Mark, but New Testament scholars wouldn't say this is multiply attested. Well, it's in Mark and it's in Matthew. Well, see, Matthew is borrowing from Mark. Mark wrote first. 90% of Mark is either in Matthew or in Luke. But it is in Mark. Matthew got it from Mark. So it is there at least. What we can say is that both of them record this as being true. Verse 52, the tombs were opened. Those who were dead were raised. Agairo, they were raised from the dead in this verse. That same exact word is used for Jesus being agairo, raised from the dead. What about verse 53? Coming out of the tombs, after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now look at this. Here we go. Verse 52 and verse 53. Look at this closely. After his resurrection. If you asked Lycona, is that in the historical genre or in the apocalyptic genre? After his resurrection. Jesus' resurrection. Those three words. Was that historical or was that non-factual apocalyptic? He would say, without a doubt, guys, I wrote a 750-page book on it. It's literal, historical. Like he physically rose? Absolutely. Biologically? Yes. Factually? Yes. This little clause here, after his resurrection, historical genre. Now catch this. But the rest is in the apocalyptic genre. Let me put that a different way. It's apocalyptic, and then all of a sudden you bracket off historical, and then it goes back to apocalyptic. Then we switch over in verse 54, or at least verse 55, to historical. This is all one sentence in Greek. Kai, the word kai, it has multiple different usages, but typically the majority of the usages, maybe 80%, is and this, and that, and the other thing. Here's Charles Quarles. He says, the quote, special effects interpretation requires a shift in genre from historical narrative to apocalyptic in the middle of a single sentence. Then, back to historical narrative in the next sentence. If a writer flows so quickly and freely from historical narrative to apocalyptic, one could hardly ever know the author's intention. Oh, is he right about that? That is so true. How do you know? How can you tell when it's apocalyptic and when it's historical? The author's intent, this is from his review, roundtable discussion, academic discussion with Mike Lacona, Charles Quarles. You should read that. Then it says, he entered the holy city and appeared to many. Anethanizo. Same root word, thanes. Anethanizo or emthanes is used for, guess who? Jesus' resurrection. So the same word for the appearances of the dead saints is the same word used for the appearances of Jesus. Now, verse 54, the centurion and those who were with him, keeping guard over Jesus, when they saw the earthquake and the things that were happening, became very frightened and said, truly, this is the Son of God. Wait, we have witnesses of not just the earthquake, but the things that were happening. What were the things that were happening? What were the things that were happening? Oh, they're just apocalyptic, non-factual, non-literal. But these non-literal apocalyptic things caused this centurion to say, truly, this is the Son of God. Moreover, an earthquake and guards shaking from fear appears where else? At Jesus' tomb when he rose from the dead. If you're going to take this, if you're going to be consistent, you need to buy the whole farm here. All right, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If we're going to take it over here, we got to take it over there as well. Consistency. We need to be consistent. Now, Mike Lycona is a smart guy. He must know that there's a difficulty here. How does he himself account for this slippery slope in his interpretation or his hermeneutic? Well, he gives two principal arguments, and I'm not quoting here, but I'm summarizing his work. He says, number one, the early Christians didn't interpret Jesus' resurrection as poetic. Okay? I'm saying that the rising of the saints, that was legend, special effects, apocalyptic, poetic. But the early Christians, they didn't take Jesus' resurrection as poetic. Number two, the Christian opponents, the enemies of Christianity, didn't interpret the Christian claim of the resurrection as poetic either. Okay, the question is, why? If they were using your hermeneutic, Mike, they would have taken it as poetic. So this actually works in reverse. If they were using your hermeneutic, they would have taken it as poetic. The fact that they didn't take it as poetic shows that they weren't using your hermeneutic. Let me point out, too, so-called Christians today say that Jesus rose in our hearts. Jesus rose as a... This is precisely what they're doing today. And what's stopping them in an interpretive way? Nothing. Nothing on this view. On this view. Enemies of Christianity say Jesus never rose from the dead. It was poetry. It was something good for the Christians to believe, to lift their spirits. But it never really historically happened. This is precisely what they're doing. Here's Charles Quarles again. He says, neither is there evidence that early Christians regarded Matthew 27:52 to 53 as metaphorical, nor that ancient opponents argued along these lines. He's saying, again, if you're going to go that route, that the Christians didn't take it as poetic and the enemies didn't take it as poetic, the Christians and the enemies didn't take this passage as poetic. So if we're going to be consistent, we would have to say that their view should be applied to the historical genre. Again, I hope you can pick this up. Consistency. Consistency. What we do over here needs to be used consistently across the board. In this methodology that he's espousing here, used consistently is going to wreak all sorts of havoc. I remember when this book came out, I was talking to an older believer, and in his wisdom, he turned to me and he said, James, he's denying this now. It's not going to stop there. He's going to deny one thing after another, after another, after another. And I said, I don't know. You know, maybe I'm just a consonant optimist. You know, maybe I'm just a bright and cheery person. But I said, I don't know. I've seen this guy debate. You know, I've seen him defend the resurrection. I know he believes the resurrection. And he's shed, you know, blood, sweat, and tears defending the Christian faith. This isn't the kind of guy that would, you know, deny, go around and deny other things in the Gospels. He wants to defend the Gospels. Boy, was I wrong. Page 306, we read, some embellishments are present. A possible candidate for embellishment is John 18:4-6. You know what that scene is? That's where Jesus is betrayed by Judas. The cohort shows up. They go to arrest Jesus. And then we read in verse 6, when Jesus had said to them, I am he, ego eimi. Incidentally, that's the Greek translation of the word Yahweh in the Old Testament. Ego eimi, Yahweh. When Jesus said, I am he, the soldiers drew back and fell to the ground. Now, Lycona says, this is a possible candidate for embellishment. Now, here's something I also want to make you aware of. Very frequently, when people try to deny inerrancy, they will couch what they say with subjunctive terms. This might be a way of understanding the passage. This could be a way of interpreting it. This is, how's he put it, a possible candidate for embellishment. It might be the case that space aliens knocked over that cohort of guards. It might have been that they all had irritable bowel syndrome and fell to the ground. Or it might have been embellishment. If we don't think that that's on the table, then don't put it on the table. Because once you say that might be the case, you're opening up the door wide open. How would I answer this passage? What's wrong with saying, I don't know? That's my fallback. You say, oh, that's so non-intellectual. I don't think so. I think we've got great evidence for the historical reliability of the New Testament. And if I come across one anomaly, that's going to throw my faith away? You kidding me? If I'm a scientist and I see in multiple different disciplines that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and then I come across an anomaly that says it's actually 6,000 years old, what do I do? Do I just completely throw out all of, you know, paleontology and radiometric dating and the starlight from distant galaxies? Do I just throw that all out because I've got one anomaly? Isn't it fair to say, I don't know? In this case, I think I have a good answer. But let's just say, I don't know. Let's say you don't know. I think that's perfectly responsible. I'll tell you what. I think it's more responsible than saying, John embellished. The guards never fell to the ground. I think that is irresponsible to say. All right, how would you take it? Here's how I would take it. John chapter 7, it says that the guards were going to, and actually being ordered to arrest Jesus, but they wouldn't. Why? Because they wanted to hear what he had to say. Repeatedly, Jesus is escaping from the guards whenever they're trying to catch him. Jesus is a miracle worker, something that is agreed upon by even critical scholarship, that Jesus was a miracle. Not that he actually did miracles, but critical scholars will say they, the people, believe that he did miracles. So you've got a cohort of guards with some moderate sympathies, John 7, to Jesus. And they're looking around and they're saying, why did they get a cohort to arrest a penniless preacher from out in the sticks, out in Galilee? I don't know. What do you think, Brutus? I don't know. I mean, this guy has been doing miracles, you know. And I got another question, Brutus. Why do we have to get him in the middle of the night? Is this spooking anyone else out? I mean, we're in the middle of the night with torches and one of his disciples is betraying him. And we've never been able to catch this guy before. And here we are again. And there's hundreds of us, and we're supposed to go out here and catch him. You think they might have been a little bit spooked? When Jesus said, I am he, do you think he put a little bit of chutzpah into it? You know what I mean? First time he said, who are you here to capture? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, I am he. Then he comes back a second time. I think he said, I am he! Oh, man. Carson, in his commentary on John, says, probably the first guys in line stepped back. It pushed all the rest of them back. They were on a slope. This is on a slope. Did you know that? That was on a hill. No, it's an embellishment. It's an embellishment. I think that's a plausible answer. Is it the right answer? I don't know. I wasn't there. All I know is that the text from the eyewitness who was there, John 19:35, who witnessed these things, he says that he was there. What about this? If minor details were unknown, they could be invented to improve the narrative while maintaining historical verisimilitude. This has been called, quote, creative reconstruction and, quote, free composition. They could invent speeches, freely compose and reconstruct whatever they wanted. Well, just for minor details, minor details. What makes it minor? At what point do we say it's a minor detail or a major one? Now, I'm not trying to do the paradox of the heaps. You know, where over here you got a couple grains of sand, and over here you got a mountain of sand. And at what point does it go from a couple grains of sand to a pile of sand? I'm not trying to do that. What I'm trying to point out here is he doesn't give any definitive line to say that these are minor and those are major. This is opening up the door to what? Creative reconstruction, free composition, and invention on behalf of the author. What kind of things are we speaking to? Page 165. John redacted, my God, why have you forsaken me? Remember that line in Matthew 27:46 and in Mark 15? Jesus is on the cross. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. John's version of those words was, I am thirsty. Excuse me? John reported Jesus' words, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, as, I am thirsty? That's what he's saying. It isn't the case, according to him, that Jesus could have said two sentences from the cross. Like maybe he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? In one instance, he's up there for a few hours. Maybe he said more than one thing. Maybe he said, I am thirsty. Maybe he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? No, he's saying that this is John's portrayal of the same statement from Jesus. Anybody else have an issue with that? Well, how does he argue for this? He gets it from Dan Wallace, who says that in the gospel according to John, catch this, water and being thirsty is always synonymous with being drained of spiritual life. So John 4, the woman at the well, I'll give you living water. I am the living water. Or anyone who comes to me will never thirst. John 7:38, this he spoke of the Holy Spirit, whom had not been given because Jesus had not been glorified. And on and on and on it goes. So he's saying, well, I am thirsty is the same as saying all of the water, spiritual life was taken out of me. And so it's the same as saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Here's the problem. John 19:28, Jesus said, I am thirsty. And then they reached for a sponge and they gave him some sour wine on a branch of hyssop and brought it up to his mouth. They didn't interpret him as saying that he was being rejected by God. They interpreted him as saying, how do I put this? That he was thirsty. That's how the text portrays itself. Are there theological undertones in the statement that we could get from the woman at the well and John 7:38 and 39? I'm sure. But to say that John redacted Matthew and Mark with these words, Luke compresses all of the appearances in the ascension to have occurred on the same day as Jesus' resurrection. Do you hear what he just said? What does he mean by compression, first of all? Luke compressed all the events, you know, the appearances, the teaching, the 40 days. He compressed that all down to one day in Luke 24. Same author, but he's compressing it. Compression on page 20 is when an author knowingly portrays events over a shorter period of time than the actual time it took for those events to occur. If this is the case, then the author has performed compression. What this means is he's saying that Luke was equating 40 days with one day. Luke 24 is knowingly portraying the resurrection all the way to the ascension as a one-day period, but then in Acts chapter 1, it's portrayed as a 40-day period. Has anyone in this room been stumbled by this Bible difficulty before? Am I the only one that looks at this and says, not only have I not cared about it, but I've never met anybody who's cared about it. I've never met a non-believer who's come up to me and said, how do you deal with this incredibly difficult problem? In Luke 24 and Acts chapter 1, this isn't even a necessary harmonization. There's nothing to harmonize. In Luke 24, it says in verse 29 on the road to Emmaus that the men asked Jesus over for dinner and the day was nearly over. It's the end of the day. Then we read that Jesus disappears and the two men traveled all the way to Jerusalem. This is about 6 miles. We don't exactly know where Emmaus is, but they travel 6 miles. Jesus eats another meal with the disciples. Remember, he's eating the broiled fish. Remember, and he's, a spirit wouldn't be able to do this because I'm flesh and bones. I can actually eat. He's gnawing on the fish bone. Then he expounds the scriptures. This goes on for a while. Then they all walk to Bethany. That's 1.5 miles away. That right there. Are we to believe all of those events occurred on one day? Maybe. Maybe that all occurred. Maybe that's all jam-packed into one day. Maybe it is. But then we get to Acts chapter 1, verse 3, and it says, Luke specifies that Jesus appeared over a period of 40 days. And then he ascends. Acts 1, 9 and, to 11. Could you say that happened on one day? You could. Does Luke require you to say it? No. This is an explanation for something that isn't a problem. What about this? Luke chapter 6, the Pharisees were silent when Jesus was about to heal the disabled man. They don't speak. Jesus reads their thoughts. Matthew 12, the Pharisees do speak. Contradiction. Mark 3, Luke 6, they don't speak. Matthew 12, they do speak. They don't speak, they do speak. Like Onus says, Matthew takes the thoughts of the Pharisees and converts them into a dialogue with Jesus. Mark is right. Luke is copying Mark. They're the ones who are correct. The Pharisees didn't speak. Matthew wanted to turn this into a dialogue, even though the Pharisees never spoke a word. Now you might say, oh, come on, that's minor. Matthew's just explaining the historical narrative in a way that, wait a minute. Matthew has Mark. Why is he adding a dialogue that never occurred? Again, Has anyone here been terribly troubled by this horrible Bible contradiction? I never have. And again, let me point out, I sent out that video. A contradiction is that A equals not A in the same time, same place, and same respect. A equals not A. I am in this room and I'm not in this room at 7:46 p.m. on this particular date. And when I say in this room, I mean ontologically here on the platform, not just like in spirit in this room, in the same way, the same place, in the same respect. Is this a contradiction? The Pharisees didn't speak and the Pharisees did speak. No. Mark and Luke do not state that they were silent the entire time. They don't say that. This isn't ad hoc. This isn't saying, okay, so you're just going to kind of blend these together and harmonize them. It isn't a contradiction. That's not what the term contradiction means in the philosophical literature. That's not what it means. There is no contradiction here. They do not say that they were silent the entire time. In fact, if you put these narratives together, they fit like a hand in a glove. In Matthew, Jesus says, is it lawful to heal? Or excuse me, the Pharisees say to Jesus in Matthew, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, Rabbi? In Luke and Mark, almost verbatim, Jesus asks them, I ask you, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? Can you picture this in your mind? You got a disabled man. You got Jesus. It's the Sabbath. They're all looking. What's he going to do? Is he going to heal him? If he heals him, he's breaking the Sabbath. So they go up to him and they prompt him. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, Rabbi? And Jesus answers a question with a question. Isn't that total Jesus right there? Isn't that Jesus' method of operations? You got a question for me, huh? I got a question for you. I ask you, is it lawful to do good or do harm on the Sabbath? And they were silent. That's what Mark records. He silenced them. Then he burned with anger in his heart, and then he healed the man. These aren't contradictory. They're complementary.